Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the upcoming watershed primary vote on Super Tuesday that is expected to clarify the presidential field on both sides, with Hillary Clinton declaring her campaign is going national, while Donald Trump predicts huge results for himself. Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Why Tuesday is Still Super, and what appears to be a critical turning point in the 2016 presidential campaigns, with Super Tuesday's 595 delegates up for grabs on the Republican side and 1,004 on the Democratic side. Then we will speak with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and is the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. We'll discuss the contours of Hillary Clinton's campaign outlined in her victory speech in South Carolina and the influence that Bernie Sanders has had in pushing the Democratic narrative to the left, as well as the possibility that the nasty and divisive Trump campaign will reverse itself in a general election with Trump sounding like a liberal Democrat. Then finally, we will look into the two-week ceasefire in Syria that is largely holding, even though it only applies to the so-called moderate rebels and not al-Nusra and ISIS. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and author of Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan, joins us to discuss why he thinks the U.S. is going along with the Russian initiative, which is not a zero-sum game or some Cold War plot to outdo America, but is the only hope to end Syria's civil war. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing in America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Why Tuesday is Still Super. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And this Super Tuesday, of course, originated in 1984 as a counterweight to the early primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire. So it hasn't necessarily worked out the way that it was envisioned, but how do you see it working out this year in that context?
Oh, look, the major goal of this used to be to give Southern Democrats a way to moderate the results of the early primaries, and it was to create the first national competition where candidates that didn't have big resources, financial or organizational, would fall away. That's not working anymore because of the way campaign finance is working and other factors, but it will still be relevant. You still have a huge delegate count. It could easily solidify the person who used to be the insurgent in the Republican Party but is now the front runner, Donald Trump, and this is really Bernie Sanders's, in some ways, last opportunity to really make a mark on the delegate count so that people in the next round are still enthused about his campaign. So it still plays a pretty decisive role.
So why is it, though, that the Democrats almost have twice as many delegates, 1,004 up for grabs compared to 595 for the Republicans?
Well, you know, the rules of each party, we forget, are done differently. Each party makes different calculations in terms of the scheduling of the primaries and obviously the number of the delegates in each state. And the states have played around with this for a long time. You know, a lot of the states voting for the Democrats used to vote much later. And then in the 1980s, they start to front load this, especially all these southern states that are voting. So the parties really make calculations in terms of how to get the strongest and best candidates for the convention.
And there are the Republicans have some more states, don't they, than the Democrats they're running in?
Yes, that's true. It's not simply the number that they're running, the number that are competitive. And, you know, the Republicans face a situation where even with Donald Trump doing well, there is also just more states where candidates feel they have the potential to win other than Trump. So you see much more active campaigning across the nation, whereas Sanders has really narrowed his campaign efforts now to a few big states, Massachusetts, Minnesota, where he thinks he has a chance, and pulled a lot of his efforts from southern states.
And Vermont. Right.
Yeah, well, Vermont, he's assuming he'll win. If he doesn't, he has a problem.
Right. So what's your sense then of how obviously Trump getting the endorsement of Governor Christie, who's the former head of the Republican Governors Association, that's pretty inside the beltway in terms of the GOP establishment, which is a word that's used a lot, even though obviously the smoke-filled rooms don't operate anymore, and they clearly have been apoplectic about Trump and have tried to figure out all kinds of ways to stop him. But it looks as if Christie's any indicator, they're starting to decide that they're going to have to coexist with him.
That is absolutely true. I mean, there's been articles recently about what exists of a Republican establishment is starting to feel that there isn't much opportunity to stop Trump anymore, that this is a elusive quest that some people are on. And so some Republicans make a political calculation that, you know, if he's going to win, then you want to support him, not just for the party, but for yourself. And that's clearly at work with Christie. You don't want to be isolated from a front runner, particularly one with the temperament of a Donald Trump. Christie is still, you know, he's not alone, but there's still not many of him. So I think everyone's waiting to see, do other dominoes start to fall. But for Trump, if he does well in Super Tuesday, if he pulls a significant number of delegates, my guess is you'll have more people like Christie who are connected to the party, who are as insider as we have these days, start to throw their support behind this nomination.
So do you expect him to win Florida? That seems to be the case. He's way ahead of the junior senator, who's his main rival, Rubio, who Trump, of course, keeps accusing of being the absentee senator. And I have interviewed a number of political analysts down in Florida who say that that's actually a real issue down there, that the people of Florida, you know, feel that they elected this guy to do a job that he hasn't done.
There are some people who are predicting a virtual sweep of the South, and the polls in Florida are pretty positive for Trump. Trump does have a presence also, so in part, it's frustration with Rubio. In part, it's that Trump has been part of that state for a long time, including, you know, real estate hotel operations that he has. But if Rubio can't pull his own state and Trump can do pretty well in a lot of the other southern states that are a play, Alabama and Georgia, you know, the only one that's a real question, it seems, is Texas, where Ted Cruz certainly hopes he can win. But if that's even close, it's going to be hard for the other Republicans to make a case that Trump is unelectable in solidly conservative states.
So the fact that the so-called Republican establishment, and I think it largely comes down to Mitt Romney in this case, have been leaning on Governor Kasich to pull out of the race to help Rubio, do you think that that's, even though Kasich is clearly resisted and somehow thinks he's got a chance, obviously he's probably going to win Ohio and perhaps Michigan, that's kind of futile at this point?
Well, I mean, I think the calculation that he's making, and then Rubio to some extent, is that, you know, that they see what Trump has done, they believe now that this is real, but there also is still an element that Trump could implode at any moment, given the kind of person he is, given the newness of the kind of campaign we're seeing. So it takes a lot to get them to step out, because it's almost like a gambler's bet that tomorrow things are going to be different and that tomorrow the situation can change dramatically. And so Kasich doesn't want to give that up. And, you know, if you took Trump out of the equation, he could be a pretty strong candidate for the GOP right now. And obviously he's looking at Ohio and Michigan, and he sees states that he can win. But the party wants to solidify now around one person other than Trump. Those who don't like Trump want to do that. And so there's pressure. But Kasich's going to resist it because I think no one still believes, even if they see Trump is real, they're not convinced it's going to last through the summer.
Well, they've been on thinking that way since day one, and it's not worked out, has it?
Agreed. It's been a big mistake. And if I'm using the comparison with a gambler, they often make that mistake. Right now, those predictions again and again have been wrong. Trump is an erratic person, and there's a lot of stories still to tell about his life. So I think there's still a curiosity and wonder if that could ultimately undercut him. But I do think after Super Tuesday, after the next couple weeks, there comes a point where I think some of that optimism from his opponents will fade away.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Why Tuesday is Still Super. So what about the other fellow, Cruz, another backbencher, junior senator, another Cuban-American for that matter? I must say, Julian, the moment in the last debate that they had, as you well know, was like a sort of junior high school name-calling brawl. But there was one moment that I thought was extraordinary, and that was when Trump was baited by both of them on either side of him. He was like the big dog, you know, the alpha male in the middle, and these two guys are yapping at him from the side. And Cruz accuses him of wanting socialized medicine. And Trump insists, no, I just don't want people to die in the streets in America. And then they both chime in saying, see, you want socialized medicine, which is another way for Trump, for Cruz and Rubio to say, we want people to die in the streets in America. I mean, what has happened to this country that we are so the debate is so debased and so and cruel?
Well, I must say, back in 1964, Lyndon Johnson, when he announced the war on poverty, and he's talking to advisors, and he said, "How could anyone possibly be against this proposal? Because who's going to stand up and say they're in favor of poverty?" And he was surprised when all the Republicans in 1964 voted against the war on poverty. And there is an element of anti-government politics, which is pretty strong. But I do think that was a striking moment in the campaign. Part of that is what makes Trump appealing to people, his willingness to say that. But there is a really very conservative strain of the electorate that hears that exchange and is quite comfortable with the way you characterize it. And, it's kind of radical free marketism, if that's a word, at play. But I think that's part of the electorate that has become very important to the GOP. And Trump, while in that case he's not standing on its side, on other issues like immigration, he very much plays to it.
So what, in your estimation, Julian Zelizer, explains the high turnout that the Republicans have been having so far and the low turnout that the Democrats have been having? It's being referred to as the enthusiasm gap. But you can't help feeling that part of the what's got the Republicans fired up is Donald Trump. So for all of his divisiveness and all of the idea that somehow he's going to suddenly implode, he seems to be a huge draw.
Yeah, I mean, look, part of this is the fact Obama is president. And so since there's a Democratic president, since there's a lot of animosity toward that president, Republicans are just more fired up. They feel there's more at stake, regardless of who the candidate is, to getting a Republican in the White House. Part of it is Trump's, appeal. And there is clear enthusiasm for him. I think he's a big factor. He has a draw right now that Hillary Clinton has been unable to achieve for the Democratic Party. And finally, there is the fact Republicans have a lot of candidates, and so each one is bringing different factions, some who have never been part of the political system, others who have, into the primary process, where Democrats don't quite have that kind of volume. But the second factor there is one both the Republicans and Democrats should take note of. Donald Trump is generating electoral excitement, and they shouldn't miss that fact as they make their campaign plans.
And even though he was asked many times in a CNN interview with Jake Tapper to distance himself from David Duke, the former KKK leader. He didn't. Again, it's amazing that what this guy can get away with. Or do you think that's something we should be concerned about in terms of the electorate itself?
Well, you know, that's something else. The same way we keep hearing that at some point the Trump candidacy will fall apart, we also keep hearing he can't keep saying those things. And he clearly was not firmly disassociating himself from David Duke, who it's hard to imagine that name didn't ring a bell to him, or that he wasn't told who it was. And when he does that, it's calculating. And there, too, you know, candidates send signals to the electorate that send signals about policies regarding race, immigration. And so, I think thus far it says a lot more not about him but about the electorate, that they are willing to take a candidate, to support a candidate who is willing to make these kinds of statements and stand by even tenuous associations like this rather than just say, that's not support I want.
But the same tactic was used in Sunday's Face the Nation interview on CBS, where Trump was asked about his tax returns, and he kept saying the same thing over and over, that he's being audited by the IRS. And when he was told, well, the IRS doesn't care, you can make them public, that's not a barrier, he just kept repeating the same thing over and over again. Do you think that tactic's going to last? So far he seems to be getting away with it, but it's pretty brazen.
Well, that's his style. He says what he wants to say. He will repeat the same point, and whether it's controversial or whether it's evasive, he sets the terms of the discussion with a kind of aggressive style of explanation that thus far has worked. You'd think the IRS, to say you're being audited so many times, might raise suspicions, might raise concerns. You know, even if you like Donald Trump, you might be saying, what's that about? Is there going to be a problem down the line? But thus far, it's worked for him. And what he does is make statements that attract attention. And he's understood the way the media works very effectively. And the publicity and discussion that has surrounded his campaign has outweighed any controversy or risk that comes from those statements.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. And his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Why Tuesday is Still Super. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. And his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Nice to be back.
And Richard, I was just mentioning to Julian Zelizer about the last Republican debate that turned into a kind of schoolyard name-calling brawl. Mm-hmm. and you had this peculiar image of the big dog, the alpha dog there in the middle with these two yapping dogs, the two junior senators running for second and third. Obviously, they're running for first place, but they're right. stuck in second and third, you know, heckling him and hectoring him. And then Ted Cruz says to him, look, you know, you're in favor of socialized medicine. And Trump says, no, I'm not. I just don't want people to die in the streets of America. I don't think we should have people dying in the streets of America. At which point, both Cruz and Rubio chimed in, said, "See, he wants socialized medicine." The subtext is so obvious. These guys are perfectly okay with people dying in the streets of America.
Right.
I mean, I just couldn't believe I was hearing that.
Well, you know, they're in desperate straits right now, and they go to ideological assumptions that have been present in the conservative movement since the New Deal. I mean, this isn't Reagan politics. This is ancient politics that goes back to the 1930s and even in some ways back to the 19th century. And I think that what Trump does is actually channel the conscience of many ordinary conservatives who don't think of themselves as ideological conservatives, but just sort of no-nonsense, hardworking men and women. They don't, in fact, want poor people dying in the streets. That bothers them. But they still become confused and make a choice to damp down or constrict government when they see a cost being imposed by that government. But their solution to solving those problems of people dying in the streets is to have religious organizations move forward to step in, or nonprofit organizations move forward to step in. Not that they don't want to address these problems that all of us see as crimes of inhumanity, that they have a theory of how to do it that's been time and again proved to be ineffective.
But, of course, the whole argument is bogus, because there is actually a law on the books that you can't let people die in the streets. So it's not exactly – and none of it's factual, but I
was going to say, Ian, what has that got to do with the Republican debate? You caught me off guard there. What side discussion are we having?
That's true. It's a fact-free zone. But it's interesting, though, that Trump is able to say stuff that's incredibly nasty, but these other guys I thought were even nastier in their glee that they thought they'd caught Trump on that he was a socialist. At the same time, they're essentially saying we're okay with people dying in the streets.
I think that's a very well taken point. I mean, I remember Carly Fiorina in one of the earlier debates was trying to run a list of those government those hateful government regulations that she wanted to get rid of. And she pronounced the minimum wage as like the second on her long list of government regulations. I said, "But see, Arena, outside the boardroom, you don't have any idea of what you've just done. 75% of Americans are in favor of increasing the minimum wage, not abolishing it." But she was never a factor. But it's representative of how the candidates have repeatedly gone to ideological planks that were, in some sense, interesting because they seem to be alternatives in the 1980s, but that haven't had biting relevance now for 20 or 25 years.
So, Richard Parker, let's turn to the Democrats, since there was such a resounding victory by Hillary Clinton in South Carolina, essentially 75-25, roughly 50 points ahead, and her victory speech in South Carolina was very much, I think, the contours of her presidential campaign. And, of course, she said, you know, that we're going national, which is not exactly a subtle hint, that she feels that she's sort of over the hump here in terms of her competition with Bernie Sanders. And there's 1,004 delegates up for grabs on Tuesday. And it's pretty likely that Hillary Clinton will get most of them.
Right.
So, first of all, is that a problem in a way? Because to my mind, Bernie Sanders has been one of the most important things that's happened in American politics for the longest time, because he's what he's introduced to our otherwise constipated and narrow political debate.
Yes. No, absolutely. I think a couple of things. One is that I've yet to see any commentator note the fact that South Carolina is a state that neither she nor Bernie could possibly win in the general. And in fact, we're going to have Democratic primaries in a number of states this Tuesday, in states in which the Democrat has no chance of winning. And so she's winning in states that she can't win in, which I find to be a peculiar way to establish your ability to win. But setting that aside, look, Sanders has been enormously useful in letting fresh air into a sealed, what has been a sealed room in many ways for the last 30 years. You know, I think what we all understand is that something profound is changing right now. This is a decade in some ways like the 1970s, as the long Reagan era, as the long Roosevelt era finally comes to an end and a new long Reagan era is about to begin. I think really we're seeing the end of the Reagan era, but we can't name yet what this next era is going to be or what exactly it's going to be like, although my assumption is that it's going to be more liberal than the long Reagan era that we've been through. And by liberal, I mean there's going to be much more attention to income and wealth inequality. How well it's addressed, that's another issue, but it's going to stay front and center as an issue. I think that issues of corruption and unfairness that can range from the ways in which hedge fund managers are compensated to corporations like Apple hiding billions of dollars in Ireland to avoid U.S. taxes are going to become large issues. I think that the environment is going to once again start to loom large. So I think that liberal agenda issues are going to surface over the next 20 years really quite steadily, and that the Republicans have fewer and fewer viable answers that are persuasive to a significant number of people. Their base is getting smaller as a percentage of the population, and they're not expanding their narrative to any of the third wave migrants in any significant way. So I look at this as we're entering a long Democratic period, but we're in that that birthing period of enormous pain before the era actually emerges.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and was the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. So do you think, though, that one of the things that Sanders is doing is tying together a kind of narrative that explains what's happened to this country in terms of its drift away from democracy towards plutocracy? And I thought one of the most telling examples has been the fact that Dow Chemical, this huge multinational corporation, has decided to pay close to $1 billion fine for price fixing. This was a case they took all the way to the Supreme Court, and they thought they had it in the bag because of Justice Scalia's earlier opinions on the matters at hand in this case, because he was such a pro-corporatist. As is the majority on this court. We talk about them as conservatives, but very often, or very rarely, do we talk about them as corporatists, which they all are. If that doesn't tell you something, to my mind, of what not one what's at stake in this election, but two, in general, how deeply corporate America has taken over our politics, and they've been very strategic. They've started at the state level. They control most of the, through ALEC and other organizations, they control most of the legislatures and governorships. And clearly they control or have enormous influence over the House and Senate. So I'm surprised in many ways that issue of the $1 billion fine hasn't turned on a few more light bulbs in people's consciousness.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one is that I fully agree with you about the role of concentrated wealth and money. I think that it has grown more and more influential. And yet we have to look at the fact that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, neither of whom were blessed with a large stable of wealthy donors. Trump's an individual case, but Trump's not even spending money. That candidates with messages can break through the plutocratic Iron Curtain in remarkable ways every so often. And I think that's what we have to remind ourselves, which is that we have got a kind of democracy that evolved over 200 years into one that actually has, in some ways, solved most of the questions of representation at the ballot box, meaning We've removed the disqualifications that were placed on people of color, on women, et cetera, et cetera. And so the representation base is much broader than it's ever been before. But the concentration of power and the ways in which it is harnessed are in some ways less democratic than they ever have been. You know, I see it analogously at Harvard, and I see it in other Ivy League schools as well, too, which is in the last 30 or so years, we've really opened up the variety of people who enroll in these elite institutions. I mean, I walk into a class, and it's like facing the UN General Assembly because of the variety of people who have been admitted. And yet, you know, before the crash, over 60% of Harvard College graduates were going to either consulting or Wall Street, and it's down now to 40%, but it's still the largest block occupationally elite college graduates choose. And, you know, it's that peculiarity of a world that looks, the democracy that looks more and more like an inverted funnel that we have to work with and tap into the latency that exists in this ability of voters to now and again overturn the iron control of money.
Well, it was pretty clear from Hillary Clinton's speech, which again I think was pretty much the contours of her campaign, and I think she pretty clearly sees herself running against Donald Trump. And she's going to sort of try and appeal to the better angels of our nature and isolate the nastiness that he has exhibited. But of course, he's such a shapeshifter that he could, in a general, he could totally shift back to be sounding like a liberal Democrat.
Oh no, I think that's actually quite plausible. I mean, I've looked at him all along as never having left the role of successful businessman. I mean, what you want to do is think about how he's really made his money. It's not as a developer. It's as a brand licensor. He's got branding relationships with something like 450 different companies. But at the same time, 90% of the revenue he gets from those branding licensing arrangements come from within the United States. And what he's done now with the president's, by running for president, is to make his name a global name. He's taken the brand global. And so I think that from his point of view, this was a perfect thing for him to do as a business person thinking about the future of Trump Industries, which was, even if I get in a fight and lose, I'm going to be before the global public eye in ways that will let me sell the Trump brand in Singapore, in Rio, in Jakarta, in Beijing, that even as recently as 6 months ago would have been impossible. Think of what... Sarah Palin was able to do in terms of generating income for herself after bursting onto the national scene from the obscurity of an Alaska governorship. So multiply that tenfold or raise it to a quantum level, and that's what you see Trump doing right now. And so I think that you're right about the shape-shifting, because I don't think he's running an ideological campaign. I think he's doing a brand expansion campaign.
Well, but he I think also, though, is clearly motivated, I think. First of all, I don't believe he wants so much to be president as he wants to win the presidency. And that I think in many ways
he's a very good distinction.
And I think in many ways what has triggered his extraordinary venomous animus towards President Obama was the humiliation that he faced at that press dinner a couple of years back, when Obama had had the knowledge that Bin Laden was dead, but he went to that dinner and made fun of Trump and his TV show, saying, you know, the kind of decisions that Donald has to make would keep me up at night. And of course, then you could, you know, Trump was at the table seething. And then it was revealed that when he was making fun of Trump, the president had already made a real decision, which was and a risky one, which is to kill Bin Laden. So there was a massive humiliation there, and I just have a feeling that there's a huge psychological component in this.
I would not detract from that at all. My point was just to say he has fitted this campaign into a larger business agenda, so that he doesn't lose whatever he does.
So just touching on Bernie Sanders again in terms of his contribution to the discourse here, I find it very ironic that Wall Street is so freaked out about Sanders, and they think that he's they're more concerned that he's pushed Hillary to the right. But in effect, what Sanders is saying ultimately comes down to saving capitalism. Of course, that's always been the irony. They vilified FDR during the Depression, but he ended up saving capitalism. And it seems to be the same things at play here, because if Wall Street continues on its trajectory of capturing more and more of the economy, which is over 60% of it now is financialized, they have ceased to be the engine of capitalism and the engine of innovation. They're just a self-serving organism that's devouring itself. It's a sort of it's a private casino that's completely rigged, and capitalism cannot survive over the long term if the main players are all about extracting wealth and not creating wealth.
So I think a couple of things. I mean, like any dominant class in any period, the class is fearful of committing class suicide, but simultaneously it's a class made up of individuals who are concerned with their own well-being and their own advancement. And like the Republican race right now, collectively, the candidates who are not Trump realize that if they would agree among themselves to have everybody but one person drop out, they could fairly likely remove Trump as a candidate or as a lead candidate. But it's a collective action problem in which you can't expect individual capitalists to sacrifice their own possibility of greatly enhancing their wealth or their prestige or their power in behalf of the class as a whole. It's a conundrum.
Well, Richard Parker, let's stay in touch throughout this extremely interesting.
I think it's like the 1970s. We're leaving one long period and entering another long period. And yes, for exactly that reason, the transition is very, very interesting.
Well, I thank you for joining us.
Delighted to talk with you as always. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's the former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and his latest, Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And the truce that has been enacted in Syria, which clearly the United States and Russia helped bring about, seems to be holding by and large. There have been a number of outbreaks, but rather minor, I guess, in terms of the ongoing carnage for the last 5 years. But of course, this truce does not involve a ceasefire with ISIS or the al-Nusra Front. So given what's left of the Syrian opposition then that aren't fighting?
Well, I think they're either going to have to decamp and go home, or else they're probably going to get bombed by Russia. It's very clear that Russia is not in playing any kind of ideological game here among the Syrian opposition. Their approach is extremely black and white. If you are opposing the Assad regime with force, then you are going to be fair game for being bombed. And I think we've seen that so far, unlike the West, which is trying to distinguish among lesser and more moderate and less moderate jihadis.
So what is the U.S. motivation then for for joining in effect, what is a Russian strategy?
Well, I happen to be a great supporter of this strategy. We'll see, in fact, whether it works. But, I mean, I think the entry of Russia into the situation cannot, in general, help to be positive. For one thing, I would dismiss any thinking among some of those in Washington who say, oh, my God, now we're letting the Russians into the field, and it's a big, this is a big setback for U.S. strategically. Russia has been a major player in Syria for 40, 50 years, going back to the days of the Soviet Union. They've had one or two bases at most in Syria. These are not major bases. The U.S. has about 17 across the region. So it's hard to imagine why today's Russia should be a strategic threat to the U.S. So therefore, I think that Russia has probably more clout, maybe along with Iran, to change the political situation inside Syria in ways that the U.S. is not able to do. I think, reading between the lines, my sense is that Putin came in and said, look, you, Assad, are in a very precarious situation. You're about to fall. That's not in our interest either, depending on how this comes about. But that if you want our aid and support to rescue you, you're going to have to cooperate with us in terms of a political solution. I think that is sort of working out, but of course, how and the details and the complexities of it remain to be seen.
Well, apparently Vladimir Putin's been busy on the phone talking to the Saudi king, the Israeli prime minister, the Assad regime, and I believe Erdogan. And it would seem to me that of all the players in the region, Erdogan is the big loser, isn't it? I mean, he seems to have really mishandled the whole everything. I mean, it's just extraordinary what he seems to be, what a serial he's obviously, you can't say he's shooting himself in the foot. He has a very cynical agenda, but it seems to be blowing up in his face.
Well, yes, after an extremely successful foreign policy in the first decade of his party's rule, he's really just lost it in the last three or four years. Maybe 10 years is the limit of any politician, who knows. But lost it and has gambled heavily on success in Syria, which has eluded him in general and gotten him in trouble with all sorts of with Iran, with Iraq, with the U.S., with other states in the region. Russia has now come in and changed that game entirely. Russia has functionally excluded by its geopolitical and geographical presence along the Turkish border, excluded Turkey from a major role down the road. I think that's good because I just don't think I don't think Turkey has been able to play a constructive, positive, and visionary role in this with its obsessive determination to overthrow Assad at any cost, while the rest of the world has slowly been drifting in the direction of saying that, look, Assad is bad, but we don't want another Iraq, we don't want another Libya, and who is to say that the successors to Assad will not be demonstrably worse than Assad and his regime itself.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and the author of Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. A friend of mine is actually in Damascus, and I've been in touch with him, and he says that the whole city is on edge, that the al-Qaeda, al-Nusra people are very close. My impression was from him was that it's not quite as buoyant the mood as we've been led to believe, that the Russians have sort of rescued Assad and the tide has turned. So if that is true, if the situation is still pretty dire, that would make sense, wouldn't it, in terms of why the Russians aren't necessarily looking for a victory here, but looking for a situation in which they can make a deal.
Yeah, I wonder how easy it's going to be to make a deal with Turkey. I mean, Erdogan has been pretty adamant, although he may in the end have to face raw facts. Saudi Arabia is going to kind of reluctant on this whole situation as well. But, you know, my sense is that the Russians must have very good intelligence. They've been closely cooperating with Syria for, as I say, probably half a century by now. And I think they must know the terrain fairly well in intelligence terms. So my sense is that Russia would be using all means at its disposal, both diplomatic, in terms of trying to direct military operations against those forces that pose the most immediate threat to the Assad regime. I'm not on the ground, obviously. I have to yield to those who are there for what they see. But I would think that the Russians and Assad, of course, himself, are not going to neglect the suburbs of Damascus if they possibly can, while they're operating in Aleppo. They're gonna, the goal is to save the regime, and you go where that need takes you.
But could it be the strategy of the Russians that, and which we appear to be going along with, is since they've really, when they moved in, they really dealt some heavy blows to the non-Nusra and ISIS opposition, the very people who've agreed to a ceasefire? Is it possible that the deal would be that we'll make a deal with you guys and Assad, and then together we're going to turn our guns on ISIS and al-Nusra?
I think that's a very probable, very likely scenario, Ian. As I said earlier, Putin has not distinguished between so-called moderate jihadis, more or less moderate jihadis, but is focused on any opposition to the Assad regime. Now, those so-called moderate opposition elements he may have been targeting first, one, because they may have been in the Damascus, in the Aleppo area, more powerful. But more to the point, he does not want this ongoing discussion to continue as to who are the good guy jihadis and who are the bad guy jihadis. He wants to see them all as equally black-hatted and eliminate them. And furthermore, eliminate the hopes, desperate hopes, I think often foolish hopes of Washington, of Saudi Arabia and Turkey, that somehow these smaller elements are going to be able to turn the tide in a positive direction. Putin has essentially laid that argument to rest. And if the moderate now, I mean, I don't want to say that there aren't some good people among them. I don't even want to say that, you know, that they might not be able to run a halfway decent regime in the future, but they're not going to have the chance, from my perspective, because the always more skillful, more powerful radicals have dominated the field. And I think when it came to the fall of Assad, those are the people who will take power and not the moderates. So Putin has closed that discussion down, and I think that's why the moderates are willing to choose the ceasefire, because it's either that or perish.
Well, in terms of the opposition group that have signed the peace deal and have so far stuck to it, and it's only going to go on for 2 weeks, apparently. They're called the High Negotiations Committee. They have 97 factions of, that have agreed to respect this. So they, within the organization that's behaving sort of rationally, as opposed to, I mean, that are not al-Nusra and not ISIS, they still have 97 factions. That's an extraordinary, you know, reminds me of the Ben Carson line in the recent debate, the fruit salad of his life. this is like a military version of a fruit salad. So that's pretty
yeah. Well, I don't envy Washington's and Turkey's and Saudi Arabia's task in trying to herd all these cats into the same direction. But I think they've probably gotten the message that either they can see that they've been abandoned. On a human level, one feels sorry for such a development. But they've either been abandoned or been ordered to stand down by other. Certainly, at least the U.S. To the extent that we can control that, and that's at least why they're laying low now and want to watch how the situation evolves. I'd love to see this really be moving now towards a political solution, but I suspect it's going to take a lot of toing and froing and breaking of truces and returning to truces and that for a while until the finer details are worked out. The biggest detail here, Ian, you know, is really what's going to happen in Damascus itself. I don't think the Russians have any particular love for Assad as personally as such. They just want to guarantee their influence in Syria. Excuse me. they want to guarantee their influence in Syria over the longer run. But how do you drop Assad and bring about a new face that might encourage the country to think better times are coming? How do you do that? How do the powers that be who sit around Assad feel about this? Are they willing to throw Assad under the bus, or do they feel that if he goes, they all go? This is a very complex calculus that I haven't seen any serious and informed speculation about.
Well, given its complexity, the opposite of that in effect is the presidential debate. I mean, particularly on the Republican side, they're offering incredibly simplistic solutions that largely come down to bomb, 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 or as Ted Cruz said, make the sand glow. So how long do you think the Obama administration and Kerry can keep behaving like adults with this enormous pressure on them in this election year? Or do you think that this election is so crazy that maybe foreign policy won't be the centerpiece?
Well, it's figured somewhat in the debates, as you pointed out, and in not very responsible ways. But look, the clock is ticking with Obama there. I think obviously Obama knows that, Kerry knows that, but also Putin knows that. And so I think Putin would like now to act in every way possible to work with the United States as swiftly as possible to bring about a change on the ground that both Obama and Putin can live with, and it would be very difficult for any successor to Obama to reject or change. So that I think that's another important factor here, but it's a very tough road, and I do think that Russia continues to be the single most important hopeful factor in this equation. It can do more than any other power in the region to possibly bring about a settlement. And I don't see any settlement that Russia has helped broker as being fundamentally against American deeper interests in the region. We don't like Al-Qaeda. They don't like Al-Qaeda. We don't like ISIS. They don't like ISIS. We don't like the instability in the Middle East. They don't like instability in the Middle East. And for to grant Russia or to allow Russia to continue to have some considerable voice, dominant voice, even in Syria down the road, is not a major geopolitical threat to any U.S. interest. We hold 90% of the cards in the region at this point.
But Senator Cohen, a former Republican senator, former Secretary of Defense, he actually has made this the case that the Russia's intervention in Syria also coincided with the vast exodus of refugees, and he believes that Putin is forcing that exodus of refugees as a tactic to weaken the Europeans, to divide the Europeans, to create a social stress in Europe, and eventually trying to force the European governments one by one to peel off and undo the sanctions against him over Crimea and Ukraine.
Do you think, I think this. Go ahead.
Well, I'm saying, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I find that really very fanciful. It is conspiracy thinking of a high order. Look, I mean, there was a refugee crisis long before the Russians had turned up on the scene. The internal displacement, external displacement of Syrian refugees all over the place has been there. We didn't need Russia to do this. And furthermore, I'm sure the refugees do help destabilize Europe, but Russia does not want the situation to continue. It's also whipping up jihadi sentiments around the world, all this talk of the caliphate. Russia lives with, millions and millions of Muslims within Russia proper, and the last thing Putin wants, that's one of the reasons he's in Syria, is to see jihadi impulses flow back into Europe. So I really think Cohen is just way out of line in trying to interpret everything Russia does as somehow some dangerous geopolitical move. But look, there are neoconservatives and liberal interventionists in Washington who see this as a totally zero-sum game. If Russia gains anything, it's our loss. That kind of thinking is really Cold War mentality. There's no reason why there can't be gains that are good for Russia and for the United States and for a lot of other players in the region. And I think this is one of them.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also serves as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.